This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Like the kōkako, the saddleback, or tieke, belongs to the New Zealand wattlebird family. A family to which the huia belonged and which has been established in this country since ancient times, much longer than most of our other birds. The saddleback takes its name from the bright reddish saddle on the mark of Maui's hand. Sadly, this attractive bird has disappeared from the main islands and exists only on a few offshore islands, carefully chosen locations for resettlement away from predators, which appears to have saved the tieke from total extinction.
Community or chaos? We can construct and nurture community, or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Good day, friends. Today we have with us Craig Rennie, economist and director of policy at New Zealand Council of Trade Unions. You can podcast this program by going to oar.org and then going to podcast and going to Community or Chaos. Craig, could you talk about the budget? The budget is deemed by most commentators, including some from the center left, as more moderate than expected, and Nicola Wells lauded her budget as one that supported workers, almost as a workers' budget. How would you react to the budget, and were you surprised by anything was in it or not included? Would you talk about the budget, please?
Thanks, Marvin. There's plenty to talk about in this budget. I was asked by a friend when I left the budget lockup, what did I think of the budget on a scale of 1 to 10? How bad was it? And I replied that it was an 8. It wasn't a 10 out of 10. It wasn't a Liz Truss type budget where, you know, you can go out and buy a lettuce and it'll last longer than the Prime Minister. But it was certainly bad. And it certainly contains a number of things that we should, working people across New Zealand, should be worried about. For those who think it's less bad than it could have been, I guess that speaks to the good job of expectations management that the government did on the way through. You know, it could have been worse, but it was still pretty bad, and there are still plenty of things that people should be concerned about. We're still cutting 240 lines of expenditure. We've now got more than 5,000 fewer public sector employees. We're now, you know, we're not delivering on many of the key points that the National Party in opposition promised to deliver upon when it was in government. So there's plenty to be concerned about, I guess. But at a high level, one of the things I think, you know, your audience might want to consider is there's no plan. There's no sense in the overall, in the budget documents or in the budget documentation of any kind of economic plan, of any kind of sense of what does good look like, nor of any kind of sense of how they're going to tackle many of the economic challenges that are facing New Zealand right now.
Who benefits most from the budget and tax cuts? And who benefits least? Who's paying for the tax cuts?
We're all paying for the tax cuts, Marvin, because the money's borrowed. So essentially, we've borrowed $17.1 billion. That's the increase in the size of the debt over the next 4 years. That's helped in part by $12 billion of new bond issuance by the government. So all of us are paying for the tax cuts. It's just future all of us is going to pay for the tax cuts. In terms of who wins, clearly the key winners and the biggest winners out of this budget were landlords, who received a $3 billion tax deduction in the form of the reintroduction of mortgage interest rate deductibility. There's also winners, they are also winners because we see the return of the reduction in the 2-year bright line, which means that Property speculators can spin properties now inside 2 years and not pay any tax on those profits. And then I guess the biggest losers from the tax cuts were beneficiaries who don't receive any support from that. Anybody who uses public services, which have seen $10 billion cut to help pay for these tax cuts. And then I guess sort of finally, pensioners who anybody who's a pensioner who's on normal superannuation essentially needs will receive $2.25 a week in a tax cut. That compares to someone who's on $150,000 who will receive somewhere in the order of $20 a week.
Isn't this a budget that actually penalizes the future? That
Well, it's certainly a budget that's very much focused on the political here and now and delivering the political promises that the parties of government delivered when in opposition. There are cuts to the Climate Emergency Response Fund which is helping to tackle climate change and help deliver a sustainable economy in the future. There are cuts to the National Resilience Plan. In fact, it's ended, and that was money set aside to help tackle future disasters such as Cyclone Gabrielle. There are cuts to business, to science, to innovation, which are helping to deliver good, sustainable jobs in the future. There are cuts to customs. There are cuts to biosecurity. There are cuts to a range of areas. There are cuts. There are real terms cuts to the funding for ECE, which affects all of us. And there are cuts. There are real terms cuts to funding for tertiary education. So there's a range of areas, where you can identify future New Zealand will be paying for the money that it's handing out in the tax cuts today.
Isn't this been a problem in the last 30 years or so, generally, that we've paid too much attention to the present and not enough attention to the future?
Oh, it's certainly a challenge which is long recognised in New Zealand economics. We have currently a $210 billion infrastructure gap. That's a that's public infrastructure, schools, hospitals, roads, everything else that should exist doesn't, because we haven't paid the bills over the number of years. I live in Wellington, which is the Venice of the South, not because it's particularly attractive, but because the water infrastructure makes very visible public appearances every so often. There's plenty of things that we should be doing to help plan for a more sustainable, long run, long term economy, but we don't. And this budget simply added to those problems rather than taking them away.
When we're talking about cuts to civil service, how does employment contracts as opposed to long-term employed workers affect the civil service and the quality of the work and security of the work?
Well, civil servants are being, right now we're under attack from a range of cuts, which are at times fairly arbitrary, and not particularly, well thought through. As I say, we've cut $10 billion from public spending over the next 4 years. Much of that actually is reloaded rather than happening straight away. And so for many public sector workers, they'll be feeling huge amounts of insecurity in their work. They'll be feeling huge amounts of of threat about whether or not their projects and their programs will go ahead. But importantly, the users of public services will also be feeling the same thing. So not only will we have fewer public services in the future, we'll likely have lower quality public services, which actually ends up costing all of us more in the long run. And this is the problem that that the government faces when it talks about its social investment approach. Many times, using a social investment approach would actually mean investing more, not less. And the challenge is that the government is committed, not just now, but in future budgets, to keep investing less. In fact, the Minister of Finance said that she was locking in future budget cuts in budgets year after year after year.
We've already seen, for instance, the conservation department lose quite a few jobs. Do we want to lose species? Will this cause us to lose species if we don't fund conservation?
Not only cuts to conservation, it cuts to the Ministry of Primary Industries, which will weaken biosecurity, protections in New Zealand. It cuts to customs, which again is our front line services. It's cuts to to the Climate Change Commission, which is protecting us from the long run impacts of climate change. It's cuts to many other government departments, all of which add up to increasing risk in New Zealand, be that climate change, be that unemployment, be that economic risk. And all of those risks, with a less well-prepared, less well-resourced public service, will mean more cost to New Zealand if and when disaster does occur. And just to give you an example, we've spent more than $1 billion in New Zealand just tackling one disease, Mycoplasma bovis. And if we saw a few more of those, then many of the budgets that the Minister of Finance has just put up are pointless. They're not worth the paper they're written on, because we'll be spending billions of dollars tackling biosecurity or other natural disasters.
Do you expect the major improvements in health and education from this budget and the government?
The government promised when in opposition that it would protect health and education funding in real terms. And it also said that it would direct any savings found in those areas to frontline services. That's fine, but the evidence we have from the budget documents is that the Ministry of Health, for example, is not getting enough money even just to cover the cost of living. So in March this year, the Ministry of Health told the Health Select Committee that the amount of money that's just been allocated to health wasn't enough to cover inflation. Now, it still used that number. So that's a real terms cut. Operations grants in education, which is the biggest form of support for schools in New Zealand, that funding went up by less than inflation. So we're cutting in real terms both of those areas. And the real challenge we face is that the rising population with increased needs. So, for example, there's nothing in this budget new for special education. With rising needs, rising population, rising demand in both of those services, we'll see effectively longer wait lists and greater rationing of public services.
I had a nurse on this program a while back, the president of the Nurses Association, and she said that things like poor housing and stress also affected the health service, because more people needed health services when they didn't get decent housing, when they didn't get proper food, and when they were worried about putting food on the table for the next week. Is that a factor?
Well, I mean, it's a huge factor. All the evidence we have from the child poverty studies that exist in New Zealand, from the work of people who looked at social investment in New Zealand, is that we can make investments today that will have huge and long-term beneficial payoffs, not just in terms of lower crown spending in the future, but in terms of actual real outcomes for New Zealanders. And one of the key areas for that is housing. And we've just announced that the government has announced that it's going to stop its any new investment in Kāinga Ora, which is the provision of new state housing. Rents are rising at their fastest rate since we put rent into the consumer price index. We know that energy costs for too many New Zealanders are rising out of control. And yet we've just cut money from the Warm Up New Zealand program, which is designed to help families and help communities deal with rising energy costs through insulation and through other supported programs. So we're not only removing the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff by cutting support for people in terms of welfare payments, in terms of housing. We're also reducing the fence at the top of the cliff by reducing the investments that would stop many people falling into poverty, or stopping people from seeing the worst outcomes from poverty that we see in New Zealand.
Does this budget indicate that we're still fully into neoliberal economics?
This budget indicates the government's values. You know, budgets are about choices. Everything in the budget is a choice. There's nothing natural in a budget. Everything is a decision of the minister or the spoke or the person at the time. And those choices, when you group them together, help demonstrate the values of this government. And the values of this government are ones that say we must have tax cuts, we must have spending cuts, we must deliver support for the groups that we favour, but there's no money to support Māori or Pacifica groups. There's $100 million cut from both of those budgets. There's no money to support those on welfare, additional support for those who needed help the most. They're seeing real terms cuts. They're seeing cuts from their previous levels of support that they would get. The promises that the now opposition made, in when it was then and now in government, around working for families haven't been delivered. And so the promised support as part of the families package, so the back pocket boost package in opposition, that again won't be delivered. So it speaks to the values of this government, who it favours, and the things it wants to see done. And I would argue that those values don't reflect the values of most New Zealanders.
Does the government, can we expect rate rises because of what government isn't doing as well? I mean, middle-sized and small communities, are they going to be able to supply safe water and sewage and the like under the present situation without raising the rates considerably, maybe, you know, doubling them in some cases?
Yeah, it's a great question, Bob. And, one of the things we've seen consistently over the past couple of years are really big increases in rates payments and rate costs, because local government finance currently is not sustainable with the way it's been put together. Local government doesn't have access to enough money to pay the bills for water, to pay the bills for the infrastructure that's needed, and at the same time, it finds itself squeezed because its ability to increase rates is squeezed for political reasons. So there's a real challenge there. The removal of the Three Waters program is likely to mean that increased water costs are borne by local authorities. That means increased costs for residents in the forms of rates, bills. There's less support for local roading from Wake Kotahi, but that means that local authorities will be required to do more local roading projects themselves. That's likely to mean increased rates, bills. And we see less support from local government for many other forms of activity. And so that is likely to mean poorer quality local services from councils around the country. It's why many local authorities around New Zealand are currently facing real challenges, selling off assets, are looking to establish long-term funds, to do other things, basically to apply sticking plasters to what is a long-term problem.
Should we consider some Scandinavian countries, the local costs are met by an income tax that's comes from the inland revenue of those countries, but it still gives those local bodies economic and political autonomy. In fact, in some cases, more than our local governments. Should we consider different ways of raising money for local governments?
I think we should absolutely consider different ways of raising money for local government. There are both pros and cons with local income taxes, one of which is a problem called headquartering, where firms or individuals find themselves and their taxable address is all in one place, be it Auckland or Wellington, wherever their headquarters is. That delivers a windfall to that area, but the actual economic activity takes place somewhere else. So there are real risks associated with local income taxes. And as a consequence, we should consider carefully before we head, before we look at those and see what they might do for New Zealand. But the point that you make is a good one, Marvin. We need a different way of being able to fund one that's more equitable, one that, you know, means that we're not, where it's more progressive. We're not placing huge costs on often what are very low-income households. And we're looking to see whether or not more support from central government or from elsewhere is actually the key means of getting over the current infrastructure deficit that's driving most of local government costs right now.
And we're talking with Craig Rennie, the economist for the CTU, and we're talking about the budget. And you can podcast this by going to oar.org.nz, then going to podcast, then going to Community or Chaos. Well, Craig, what's your opinion of the fast-track legislation, and is it justified because of the hope for improvements in economic growth? And what does blind economic growth mean to the environment and the future, particularly in climate change?
One of the key challenges we have there, Marvin, is that very little is actually really known about how the fast track legislation will be delivered in practice. What it's likely to mean is foreshortened decisions on really important things like ecological management, on environmental damage, on making sure we deliver, you know, long-term improvements to our ability to sell ourselves as a country as being a clean, green country, which is actually the basis for most of our exports in New Zealand. So there's a real risk that with this legislation, we're putting other exports, we're putting other parts of the economy at risk. Now, everybody wants to see more jobs, particularly good, long-term, sustainable jobs that will, you know, help families and help create great communities. The challenge I have is that for many of these jobs, they are simply extractive industries. They're extracting something from the ground, be it oil, be it a mineral of some kind, be it coal, and then hoping for the best in the future. And New Zealand's been here before. So we actually need to make sure we're delivering a just transition for workers and for workplaces. And we're not solving any of the long-term structural problems in the New Zealand economy around how to create good long-term work in New Zealand. Essentially, the fast track is just simply a fast track to get us back to the economy we had in 2017, which wasn't going anywhere fast, but where we could prop up some jobs with some short-term economic activities. It doesn't change the economic fundamentals in New Zealand, and it does so whilst creating quite large environmental and ecological risks in New Zealand.
It's been said by commentators like Bruce Edwards and Max Rathbone that New Zealand seems to expect a Scandinavian lifestyle with health and education, but we won't have an American attitude toward taxation. Could you comment on this?
I don't think it's a particularly New Zealand problem, Marvin. I think that's a problem around the Western world. I come from the UK originally, and the UK wants European levels of public services, but it doesn't want European levels of taxation to pay for it. That's also true in Canada. And that's also true, in the US and in other jurisdictions. It tends to be a feature, particularly of Anglo countries or English-speaking countries around the world, is that we would like the best of both worlds, and we're quite open to holding that opinion, two different opinions in our head at the same time.
Aren't we getting the worst of both worlds?
Often, yes. But that's as a consequence of much of the short-term thinking, which underlies this budget, where we're saying we can trade these things off. We can cut taxes today. We can make some savings, and then everything will be better, and we can make different decisions in the future. The challenge is we cut taxes, we never make the investments necessary, and it's how we end up with a very large infrastructure gap. It's how we end up with degraded public services. It's how we end up with mould in the walls in hospitals. You're sat there, Marvin, in Dunedin, a city that's needed a full hospital rebuild for 20 years, and it never happened because we continuously kicked the can down the road. And that's the real challenge, is how do we create that consensus for a much longer term view of the economy and a much longer term view of how we're going to deliver sustainable good jobs in the future.
Do you think one reason we haven't got a consensus is we don't have a clear idea of what taxation means, and we don't have a clear tax, nobody's got a clear tax policy they're willing to talk about. What's a marginal tax rate mean for people that are less literate about taxes? It doesn't mean you tax the entire income, does it? Say
No,
if you're
not at
making
all.
100,000 a year and you have a 60% marginal tax rate of 60%, so over 100,000. Does that mean your entire income is taxed at 60%, or does that mean that over and above $100,000 a year, you might pay 60%?
Marginal tax rates in New Zealand for someone who's on $100,000 a year would be 33%.
I know.
And the overall level of tax, the what we call a tax wedge, which is the amount of money taken from the average worker, in New Zealand, is approximately 20%. Which is amongst the lowest in the OECD. So overall, we're not overtaxed as a population. In fact, core crown revenue at around 30% would look far higher if we were doing this in the UK, in Europe, or many other parts of Australia, in terms of the developed world. The challenge is that the burden of that taxation falls on income earners in New Zealand in ways that it doesn't overseas. So about 50% of our taxation comes from income tax. And about a further 20% comes from GST, which is a consumption tax.
Well, consumption tax, you're paying for food, you're paying for things to make your house run, you're paying for petrol if you can't afford an electric car. So it seems to me that the solution isn't user pay taxes.
No, the solution, hopefully, is taxation that is fair. And the challenge we have is that we have taxation that is essentially simply just we have no taxation on capital gains, we have no taxation on wealth, we have no taxation on a range of issues, and that creates giant distortions in the tax system, which doesn't help our economy, but also means that our ability to find money to pay for the public services we all need becomes harder and harder and harder.
We
And so
also
that
don't tax
out.
corporations very much, do we?
We our corporation tax is at 28%, which would be very similar to that found around the world. But the capital gains tax, the lack of capital gains tax here means that the effective rate is much lower. So there's a range of challenges to the taxation system. But the first thing that we first problem we need to solve, Marvin, is actually to think about tax in a different way. Tax isn't the enemy. Tax isn't, tax shouldn't be demonized in the way that it is. People don't like paying tax, and that's a perfectly reasonable place to be. But tax is the thing that pays for the public services we all want. If
Let's
we
start
want.
with Roger Douglas. I think the attitude toward taxation in the last 40 years has changed considerably.
I think it's become harder and harder to justify tax increases because, we rely so much on such a narrow area of tax to pay for our public services. If it was a broader base, low rate taxation system, we'd find that we actually had a much greater consensus about the ability to use the tax system. And we'd also have a stronger economy.
The average wage in New Zealand, the one that occurs most often, I think, is around $53,000 a year. And does anybody really, can people really complain about if they paid a higher tax on over 100,000? Do we really need more than 100,000 to live well?
Well, one of the things we need to look at, Marvin, is the extent to which is the tax system in the whole, in the round, actually delivering what we want. And I think the really important thing here is actually not to have the tax conversation in isolation from need, because it's really easy to get into various academic debates about how much money we should be taxing person A or person B and the fairness of that. We need to be looking at what's the overall level of need in health and education and housing, and what's the level of need to make sure that we need a really good, really great society, the one that most people in New Zealand wants to see and want to live in. And
Does
if
the
we can tackle this
C2U
problem, then we can then we can then work out how to create the tax system to then deliver the resources necessary to do that work.
Does the C2U want a debate on this?
The CTU is desperate for a debate on this. We've started a program called Reimagining Aotearoa Together, which you can find on the CTU's website, which is a national conversation about what kind of economy you want to have, what kinds of policies are really going to, shift the needle for working people around New Zealand, and how together, can we highlight the benefits of those policies and highlight what the impact that new policies that would deliver that change, the impact that would have on working people, and deliver the more productive, the more sustainable, and the more inclusive economy that certainly the CTU wants to see, and I think most New Zealanders want to see as well.
Do you think that having good education more accessible to everybody would benefit our economy? Do you think that Finland benefits from a really good education and free education for everybody?
I can't see a universe, Marvin, in which a country that has a better education system, that has a more accessible education system, and an education system where everyone is encouraged to use it, is worse off. I can't see a situation in which New Zealand would not, in its long-run productivity problems, particularly its labour productivity problems, wouldn't benefit from being able to access, skills development, mid-career training. Being able to reduce the costs of access to education, which would improve its uptake, so that actually everybody could realize their potential, and do that in ways that help benefit them the most, that help them access really great sustainable employment, that help them, lead lives that are more fulfilling for them and for their families. So the ability to access education is crucial. One of the things this budget has done has moved the first year free to the final year. And
Does that
that's really
mean that, I mean, a lot of people grew up in poor families. I learned as a child, you didn't want to go into debt because you might not be able to pay it. You might lose everything.
I'm lucky enough, Marvin, to be old enough, not to have been in a student loan system. And so, I didn't really have a huge student loan when I left university. And the idea of taking on tens of thousands of dollars of debt in order to access education would have terrified 18-year-old me at the point of accessing university. So I think the more we can do to increase access, to increase public support for education, increase financial support for education, it pays itself off in the long run in the economy many times over. And we should be doing more to increase access to education rather than doing what this budget does. This budget increases tuition fees by 6%. And so there's much that's being done in this budget to actually create hurdles and create barriers to access for education.
It seems to me that we, in many cases, particularly in health and in science, but particularly in health, we don't have the trained people we need. We're having to get them overseas. In particularly a medical care career or in dentistry, the cost of getting that kind of education is enormous. And when you finish, you've got to pay back that loan. Does that mean you're going to lower your fees? No.
No.
You have to get enough money to pay off your loan. And once you pay it off your loan, are you going to lower your fees after?
It's even worse than that, Marvin. We train those doctors and those nurses, and then because we don't pay them well, because we don't look after them, because we overwork them, they go to Australia.
But if we had more, we wouldn't have to overwork them.
Oh, indeed. But
And if people had free medical and education, and also a free education for school teaching, we might have more professional people who would stay here.
And that would be a fantastic policy model, one that I would support. the challenges are in this budget. The government, the opposition, promised that it would deliver 50 extra doctors a year. There's only funding for 25 in this budget. We're spending more on security guards for A&E than we are on training those new 25 doctors. The priorities of this government are all in the wrong place. And so we're going to continue to be reliant upon importing overseas doctors and nurses and dentists and everybody else. And we're more likely to lose many of those really valuable skills back overseas to countries like Australia or to the US or Canada, where pay terms and conditions are frankly just better.
The other question is, when are we seriously going to talk about taxation? I mean, one of the things that really irked me about the last election is that only one of the parties was talking about taxation in a serious way, and that was the Green Party. And it should have been other parties as well.
Well, I think all the parties were talking about taxation. The challenge is the word that you used after it, which is the serious conversation about taxation. And again, that comes from a frank assessment of need. One of the things we don't have right now is that frank assessment of need in New Zealand, and that frank assessment of actually what kind of society, what kind of economy do we want to have? That's the work that the CTU is doing right now in terms of its Reimagining Aotearoa Together project. But the conversation we need to have as a country around what kind of country do we want to have, and how do we then pay to get to that good place? And instead, we're having a conversation about the value of tax cuts, which in all likelihood takes us further away from the kind of country that we want to have, and certainly further away from the delivery of the public services that we all need.
What do you think the medium-term effect of this budget will have on New Zealand?
It's difficult to say at this point, Marvin, but what I would say is this, is that the budget numbers, the growth numbers, the inflation numbers, they're all much more optimistic than the Reserve Bank's projections. They're more optimistic at times than the private bank's forecasts. So as a consequence, if those numbers don't come in as the Treasury forecasts, then we're likely to see further cuts in public spending in order to keep paying for the tax program we've just promised. We're likely to see further reductions in the provision of public services. We're likely to see less money in the exchequer, which means that our ability to tackle the infrastructure gap that we have as a country gets harder and harder and harder, and we all become a little poorer as a consequence. There's a famous quote by the economist Galbraith that we can have private affluence and public squalor. And that essentially is that if we continue down this path, that's the medium-term trajectory for this country, is that we see increasing private affluence in New Zealand, but we see increasing public squalor, and we see increasing unhappiness in the public realm, and an increasing use of private sector solutions as families opt out, frankly, of public service provision because it's not being provided properly by the government.
Doesn't that increase the tensions between people and classes?
Absolutely. And one of the
I mean,
things it
isn't
does.
this one of the problems with America, is the extreme inequality?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things we'll see is an increasing use of diversions, Marvin. We'll blame beneficiaries for being poor. We'll blame the homeless for being homeless. We'll say we don't have enough money. We'll say we don't have enough time. We say that things aren't popular. And in fact, none of these things are true. But they're useful diversions away from the real problems, which is that we haven't consistently invested in New Zealand over decades at the levels needed in order to be able to tackle our problems. Instead, we've taken short-term solutions, or we've taken short-term wins in forms of tax cuts for certain groups in the hope that that will spark some kind of economic renewal. And that's not the case, and hasn't been the case for a really long time.
I think some people have actually gained from it. I think the highest 10% of...
Well, certainly the tax system right now favors that. In government, David Parker commissioned IRD to look at the incomes of the highest 311 families, earning families in New Zealand, and discovered that they had an effective tax rate of 9%. Everybody else had an effective tax rate of 21%. So currently the taxation system supports that accumulation of wealth by those higher income earners. And importantly, the structure of our economy isn't creating good, long-term, sustainable, resilient jobs. We're creating short-run jobs. We're not creating the conditions that means families have security at home, families have security in their work, families have security in public services. We're actively making them more insecure via these budget decisions.
Doesn't it create mental health problems? Doesn't it also create political insecurity? I mean...
Certainly the evidence we've seen from overseas is that higher levels of economic inequality, higher levels of wealth inequality lead to growing demands for politicians on what are often called populist politicians. I think of Trump, I think of Bolsonaro, I think of Viktor Orban in Hungary, I think to some extent of Boris Johnson in the UK, who have easy solutions to often complicated problems which aren't easy solutions at all. And those in themselves simply then lead to gain to more economic insecurity and more economic instability.
Why do people like Brexit supporters and Trump seem to get more support than people like Bernie Sanders or Jeremy Corbyn?
Because they're offering simple solutions to complicated problems and they're blaming the other. It's a tale as old as time.
They also shouldn't have much trouble getting monetary support for their campaigns.
No, or airtime. With many stations being very keen to repeat their messaging, because it's very easy to blame the other. It's very easy to say, here is a complicated problem, and if you've got a bunch of highly educated people on TV saying it's a very naughty problem, we don't really know what to do with it, but we're going to keep giving it a go. Or you've got someone who sounds confident and says, I have a solution to this problem and it's foreigners and I'm going to fix it, then that really sounds quite compelling to people who are at the end of their tether, who often are facing real challenges in terms of being able just to pay the bills, to look after themselves. The enemy of a good, modern, sustainable democracy is economic insecurity. But many of the decisions we've made over the past 30 to 40 years have added economic insecurity, not just in the UK, but around the world.
Well, that's one of the things that I thought about in the Rust Belt in America, where the economy has been very precarious, to say the least. For two terms, they supported Obama, a black American, Afro-American, and then they voted for Trump. And people saying they're racist is just not good enough. We need a deeper description of our problems than that.
But there will be academics better placed than me to comment on this, Marvin. But I mean, from my perspective, the vote for Trump was a vote out of anger, was a vote out of despair. Mr. Obama, President Obama, had offered hope, had offered soaring rhetoric, but the economy wasn't in a great place. Many people's household incomes weren't in a great place. And as a consequence, they saw a man who said, I'm going to offer you an easy set of solutions to this problem, and that everybody here is corrupt except for me. And that became quite a compelling message, until it actually had to be delivered, and the rest is then history.
Most of the problems we have, it seems to me, from climate change to unemployment to wars, have to be looked at both from a governmental level and also international level. And the choices that are seem easy and are based on fear make those problems more difficult to deal with, actually.
I couldn't agree more, Marvin. One of the things we could all benefit from in politics, not just in New Zealand but around the world, is more honesty and better debate, and more integrity in those decisions and in those conversations. We could all benefit actually from a stronger fourth estate, from a stronger press, and from more investigations from the press. And yet we see many of our leading newspapers really struggling financially, and that doesn't help anyone. And one of the things that, you know, if we want to help address the exact gap you've just talked about, we should be thinking increasingly about the media as a utility in much the same way as water or electricity or something else. Well, we all need to contribute to that utility to help make sure we have the kinds of open investigative journalism and reporting that actually helps to create a much better conversation in the public. I come from the UK where, oh crikey, 14 out of 16 national newspapers are conservative supporting. It becomes really easy to sell a message if you're the Conservative Party. It's very hard to sell a message if you're somebody else.
One of the things that bothers me about the fast track is that it may not be corrupt, but it makes corruption seem more likely. I mean, when a mining company or a corporation gets to go ahead without any real investigation of the good of the country and of the environment, and they probably contributed to political parties, how does this deal with our sense of trust?
Well, I think trust in politics in New Zealand is pretty diminished to begin with, to be deadly honest. This certainly doesn't add to the perception, if nothing else, of trust in New Zealand. And perceptions are really important here. One of the things we can be doing is making sure that decisions on very long-term economic assets like mines, other forms of transport investment, are done as cleanly as possible. And New Zealand's had a very good track record in this space. Waka Kotahi is an independent body. It makes decisions via its board very independently about where to spend transport money. We have environmental courts that make decisions very independently from the Crown. They're not open to the kinds of corruption or certainly influencing that happens in many other jurisdictions.
Fast track bypasses that.
Yeah, exactly. And this fast track takes some of those protections away. And so one of the things it does, if nothing else, even if all the decisions were made as correctly and as honestly and with the level of integrity that we would all hope, it adds to the perception of corruption. It adds to the perception of risk. And we should be doing as much as possible to minimize even the perception of corruption.
Do you hope to have future conversations, you and the CTU, about taxation, about a vision for New Zealand's future, and about trust?
Certainly. And we are right now. We're traveling around the country and talking to trade union audiences and we'll be talking to NGOs and to other people right around New Zealand this year, saying, what kind of economy do we want to have? What does a good economy look like? What are the problems in New Zealand and how best can they be tackled? And if we can do that together, then how can we develop a package of great policies that next time we have a government, we can present them to help tackle those issues together?
Okay, thanks a lot for coming on board, and I hope we have this conversation nationwide.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.